love of the game. This is Love Said Match.
I mean, Andre Agassi had this goal. You don't have to be better than everyone else in the draw when you go out on the court. Like, you have to be better than someone that's across the net.
I think you got to stay active in a sport sense, you know, go out there, do some sports. I think it always makes you feel better, maybe more tired in the very moment, but actually the rest of the day feels better. And then I think giving back as well, you know, making other people happy is going to give you a good feeling too.
Welcome to Tennis Pal Chronicles, the podcast to feed your passion for all things tennis. I'm your host, Philip Kim, also known as Coach PK, the tennis pro for the Langham Huntington Hotel in sunny Southern California. And I'm also the executive director for the nonprofit Love Set Match. With me today, I'm super excited that we're going to do a wonderful podcast with two great co-hosts. And we have Valerie Garcia, of course. Hi, Valerie.
Hey, Philip. How's it going?
It's going great. And Martin Keady is joining us from London. How are you, Martin?
I'm very well. Thank you, Philip. Thanks for having me on. And hello, everyone.
Thanks so much for joining, guys. If all of you who are listening would like to support the podcast and the mission of our nonprofit Love Set Match, you can donate a tax-deductible donation directly to us via Zelle using the email aces@lovesetmatch.org. If you want other options, you go to lovesetmatch.org/donate, and there's a bunch of other PayPal, Facebook, and other options to get involved with as well. We've got a great podcast for you today because we're going to be recapping the wonderful Madrid tournament and Rome preview as well. The clay season has started. We're in the middle of it. Guys, what did you think? Martin, why don't you start us first with Madrid? How was it for you?
Well, it was a very odd Masters tournament and WTA 1000 tournament, one of the big tournaments, in that, especially on the men's side, it was the bonfire of the stars with so many players being injured. Obviously, Alcaraz and Sinner, who are unfortunately now both out of Rome as well. We had Rafa's amazing farewell to Spanish clay, which I'm sure we'll discuss. But the absolute highlight undoubtedly was the end of the women's tournament with a wonderful final, and the second semi-final on the women's side as well was also superb. Those are the two best women's matches that I've seen in a long time, and they were both absolutely terrific.
Yeah, they got me really excited as well. How about you, Valerie?
Yeah, I hardly watched a male match the entire tournament. I wasn't due to scheduling. It's really hard to watch. It's on while I'm asleep and then while I'm at work. So I only got to catch a few matches on the weekends or rewatch, try and like record and rewatch. And I just found all the WTA matches to be way more, I guess, exciting. And it probably didn't help that all the great matchups that we could have had at the end for the men didn't happen because of all the injury withdrawals, right? And so then that kind of just fizzled. And I do love Rublev and would have liked to have seen it, but I didn't love it enough to really make the time. But yeah, I'm Iga, my gal. I felt really sad for your girl, Philip, going out in the semis, man. She fought her way there, and Sabalenka fought her way through. And I love all three of them so much. It's so hard, right, to watch because I'm like, I don't know who I want to win.
Yeah.
But deep down, I did really want Iga to win. So I was jumping up and down, screaming, and all alone in my house like a total tennis nerd.
And maybe that's why it's so exciting right now is we have basically like the top three players playing against each other, and you really don't know who's going to take it because it's not like dominance. It really adds a lot of anticipation to it. And speaking of, my girl Elena Rybakina, I mean, my heart was in my hands after I saw the score. I didn't even watch the match. I saw the score, and then I couldn't watch it for like a day because I was so depressed. I was like, man, because I know what's going to happen. Although I know I had to go back and, you know, watch and see what happened. And boy, it was close. Wow. Oh my God. She had match points.
Yes.
She had a match point.
Yes,
so
sure.
She was serving. So yeah, Martin, take us through your experience on that.
Well, it obviously, as in any WTA 1000 or Masters event, all the matches are fascinating. But on the women's side in particular, that second semi-final between Sabalenka and Rybakina, and then the final, you know, they were both stupendous matches. And I think what was so good about them was having them back-to-back like that, to see... You saw all, it was seeing all three almost simultaneously, as you were. As you said, Filip Rybakina had match points against Sabalenka. She certainly blew her away in the first set. And it was the sustained level of the quality of both those matches. For what it's worth, in the you know, we're not alone in this. A number of the Sky Sports tennis reporters here were saying that the women's match in particular was the best match they'd ever seen live, which, bearing in mind the amount of tennis and the number of finals they'd watch, is high praise indeed. It was absolutely fantastic. And if I may, I couldn't resist today, because it's so obvious. I had to say that, forget AI, artificial intelligence, A and I, Arena and Iga, is infinitely more interesting. And if you add Elena too, you know, it's wonderful. And as always, we hope that the others, Coco Gauff has already won a major, of course, so she's proved that she is a champion player. She's now got to do it week in, week out, as the new big three are, you know, the big three on the women's side. They're so well matched. As you said, Philip, quite correctly, there's no dominant one among them. And they are invariably meeting in semi-finals and finals. They're, you know, remarkably consistent. And I suppose that, if I may, it struck me today, what they're showing is, you know, that week in, week out consistency, which is so extraordinary. We took it for granted with the big three, who, even Rafa with all his injuries, you know, still in the clay court season, made most tournaments. But the younger players now, we can't assume that, for all their other attributes, Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner will be as physically near miraculous as those three. They're having injury problems. Yeah, it was the women's side on this tournament. Rublev's performance was terrific today, especially when we learned afterwards how poorly he'd been. He'd been really badly ill with something as yet undiagnosed. We hope he feels better soon. His was the finest sickbed victory I think I've ever heard of, really, because he was, you know, clearly very ill indeed. But it was the women's side. Two terrific matches, which showed that those three at the moment are just a cut above the rest, even above Coco at the moment. The others have to, you know, they've got the weapons. Madison Keys had a very good tournament, especially on clay. She's got the weapons, but she's got to get that, you know, iron will and sheer consistency of the big three.
I have definitely thoughts that I want to hear from both of you. But first, I want to say big shout out to Sabalenka for the fact that she could have lost her number two and dropped to like four, I think, a couple times this tournament, and really fought and battled to keep her number two position. And I saw a stat that she lost more games en route to the final than any other player in the history of the tournament. She dropped 60 games to get to the final. But what I wanted to ask you guys both is, I'm very interested, because we can talk about the results and what happened, but like you've said, Martin, these top three women are so equally good. And like Philip, you mentioned, that's what makes it so great, is that anticipation. Any given day, you don't know who's going to win, right? That's what makes it so exciting. But I'm curious if you guys have opinions. Assuming they're playing at their best, who do you think has the highest level of the three of them? If they stayed healthy and hitting all, you know, no mental drops and physical drops, but just playing, redlining their game. Who has the most upside to you guys?
Well, that's a lot of ifs, Valerie.
so then I guess what I'm saying that's is like who has the most
if
talent?
I was 6'5", and then...
No, because they have it in them, right? It's just that, you know, no human can be perfect on any given day at all moments, but they do have it in them, well, right?
Going
so...
Yeah.
Whose top level is the toppest?
Yeah, the toppest, if you wouldn't mind me going. And maybe what we should do is throw it to a certain person so there isn't talking over. But for me, going into the quarterfinals, of course, I'm already on Rybakina's side. But, I mean, she had won 16 straight matches on clay going into the quarterfinals. And she was 12-0 in deciding sets. So she had not lost a deciding set since that epic Blinkova match in Australian Open, which was like one of the longest in history, they said. So I was feeling really great about Elena going into this. She had beaten Iga already, so she has that confidence. She's 4-2 now. So I felt like if Elena could just beat Sabalenka, then... she had good chances against Iga, and I think she's in Iga's head is what I think. So I think she had really good chances. It was just, for me, it was amazing that Sabalenka hung, because that's a new factor for her, I feel like, that she is now mentally stronger than she was before. You saw the mental weakness in her serve and double faults and all of that. A lot of that has gone away. Her serve is really improved now. And the fact that she won this match against Rybakina on match point really showed a lot about who she was. So, you know, that gave Sabalenka a great chance against Iga. But I feel like Iga's movement is so much better than Sabalenka. So, yeah, very interesting question, Valerie. I like it. Martin, let's go with your thoughts.
Well, like Valerie, I'll begin with a real shout out, a real expression of gratitude and admiration for Aryna Sabalenka. I will just refer very briefly to the fact that obviously she suffered a personal tragedy not long ago, the loss of someone very close to her. To have kept playing at all was obviously very professional of her, but to play at the level that she has in Madrid is phenomenal. She won I'm sure an army of new fans, and I think it's quite nice when we talk about the big three. They're all wonderful and we all admire them equally, but you have an affinity with particular players, just as you had with Federer, Djokovic or Nadal. And I have to say, in this instance, I felt completely won over by Aryna, even though she lost. It was a classic case of everything that she went through to play at that level. It's disappointing that I believe she now has a 7-3, Iga has a 7-3 lead over her, which seems far too big a gap between them. 6-4 seems, you know, they're both absolutely wonderful players. And obviously there's the classic contrast. It's the classic, you know, for older netheads like myself, it evokes memories of Borg and McEnroe back in the day before the day, before the day, etc. A long time ago, but you had Borg, who was the Iceman, and Iga is not nearly as reserved as he was, but she is less demonstrative than Aryna, who seems to explode physically and emotionally into every shot. And so it was tremendous. And I'm a huge admirer of Elena as well. I love her serve, the consistency, the power, the variation of her serve. I think, as many tennis watchers do, I think she probably has the best all-round serve in the women's game. Aryna has more power, but it seems less reliable and more likely to break down. But above all, it was just wonderful. And I will just add finally, it was another demonstration of the, you know, I often say tennis is three sports in one. You have the clay court, the grass and the hard court. But it's also a further two sports in one. You have men and women playing simultaneously. And it was great that the women's tournament was so terrific this week. It really outshone the men's. Often the women's game is overshadowed by the men's. But this week was a reminder that in the top three in the women's game, you've got absolutely great champions. And everyone who likes tennis should be watching them whenever they play.
Valerie, what's your answer to your own question?
You know what, Philip? I don't even know, because I think Elena's serve is what could put her better. I think if Elena's playing her best, she's better than both of them. But I think it's very, I guess.
On any surface? On any surface, Valerie, or on grass, perhaps?
You know, I think actually on any surface, because when you look about how she beat down Sabalenka in Brisbane this year, and she has Iga's number, and Stuttgart is clay, but in indoor clay, it's different. I mean, would she beat Iga at Roland Garros? Likely not. Maybe the slower Rome and the Roland Garros, that slow red clay, maybe that's where Elena isn't better. But I do think, you know, she probably could. She moves deceptively well on clay for her size, and not being like, you don't look at her and think she's as athletic as an Iga or even maybe a Sabalenka, but she really actually moves quite well. I'm very impressed with her. I would think that if I had money to put on it, Elena at her top, I think has more talent and strokes, I guess, power, prowess, mental strength to beat the other two. That being said, though, I do think it's a testament to how Iga has been number one for years. And without a serve, right? We're talking about Arena and Elena, who have the two best serves practically.
Yes.
Not really. I mean, but there's others that can, you know, challenge them in that department, but they have great serves. They're at the top of the game, and they have great games. And then Iga doesn't really have that great of a serve, but she's just so good everywhere else that she can still. It's almost like how Rafa was in his first like 5 years before he learned how to serve.
I would say Iga is so good everywhere else at the baseline because she really lacks being able to come forward. And that's one of the things that I love about Rybakina is she has a pretty all-around game. And so I felt like Iga won against Sabalenka because she defended better and she moved better. And it was very, very close. I mean, Sabalenka's movement was much better than we usually see. So, you know, she was trying harder in this final. The thing that I hold back against the thing that I hold back against Elena is that she seems like she's always tired. Literally every match, every post-match thing, it's like, oh, I don't know if I can recover, and you know, this is a tough tournament, and we'll see how it feels, you know. And I just don't feel like her fitness level is as high as it. And she, of course, she was sick and she had problems in the past tournament, so you know, maybe some of that's still lingering, but. I feel like if she had more stamina, she would win. And I feel like that's what happened with Iga. Iga had better fitness. She was moving better, defending more, getting the ball back. She wasn't hitting winners off of Sabalenka until something mentally happened in the last set at 3-all, where all of a sudden Iga started being very, very selective and directional. Not so much more power, because she just doesn't have that kind of power, but really picking her targets and kind of swinging for the trees. For her, just means more directional, more spin, more angle, right? Pushing them off the court. And you know, because I don't think she can necessarily hit through either of those two. But once her game is on and she can literally paint the lines on both sides, backhand and forehand, great. But coming to the net, you know, anything short, she just puts away. But anything net, I never see her volleys. Very, very uncommon. So.
Yeah. She's not a slicer or a drop shotter too much either.
Right.
You know, I kind of always want to see her slice. Like, I see her running out, and she never slices.
You have a great backhand slice, that's why.
Yeah, well, I like that about Sabalenka, too. Like, I notice she will, if she's in a position, she will slice to reset, right?
Yeah.
But I guess if Iga's just fast enough that she doesn't have to slice, then she doesn't have to slice, you know?
Quite. No, you're quite. I'll say again, it's wonderful to hear you both talk about the technical aspects of tennis, which is always fascinating to me. Iga is a wonderful player, reminded us all what a wonderful player she is. You know, obviously, as you referred to, Valerie. There's a lot of Nadal about her. Rafa was her idol. She always said as much. And to me, at her best, she looks like, to use a boxing, a middleweight female version of the heavyweight male Rafa. In particular, as you were alluding to, Philip, both wings back. Rafa at his best, it was like playing two forehands. They seemed equally good. And at her best, it feels like two forehands. No weakness on either side and no apparent, you know, usually, you know, I'm sure you would agree, Philip, most players at any level will favour one side or the other slightly. But, you know, at her best, she is like Rafa coming forward with two forehands. And it was fantastic. And it was wonderful to see such a warm celebration and, you know, a very warm embrace between them at the end. They all seemed to get along very well. Also, I take your point about Elena's fitness, possible fitness issues. Just two quick points on that. One, it's entirely possible, as we've all sadly discovered over the last few years, that you can have lingering effects of a virus. She's an elite athlete, so I'm sure she's training at the top level. And she certainly doesn't look as athletic, seem as athletic as the other two. But you know, the serve will get you a long way in tennis. And if the rest of your game is very good, which, you know, it's all very good at least, that's why she really can challenge. But it was just wonderful. And it was wonderful to see women's tennis being celebrated, talked about so much. And above all, just to see two great tennis matches back to back. They were both tremendous.
And Madrid let the women speak after the... at the trophy ceremony. So we got, there's another win there. I had to get a little jab in there, you know.
No, I'm sure both Philip and I happily cede the floor to you on that, as any right-minded. But it seems they hopefully have learned from their mistakes of last year. As far as I know, I haven't seen any, you know, hard to make mistakes as big as that 2 years in a running. They don't seem to have. I read beforehand there had been issues in the past, but in this instance, above all, it was the excellence of the women's play that is what puts them in the, you know, in the absolute limelight, and rightly so. You know, it was fantastic. And in this instance, they really did outshine the men, notwithstanding, as I say, Andre Rublev's incredible performance. And if we could turn to him, Philip, if that was all right, just to segue slightly. I mean, we learned after the match that he had been incredibly ill all week, you know, really confined to his room. When you consider who he beat with Carlos Alcaraz and the other great wins he had, especially today against a rejuvenated Felix, it was, you know, a really impressive performance. So those were the two big takeaways, as they say, from Madrid: the excellence of the women's final and second semi-final, and Andre Rublev. It's lovely to talk about him in a positive light after he himself put himself in the most negative light a few months ago in the Middle East. So those two were the real highlights of the tournament for me, and I'm sure many other people.
Yeah, the highlight in the negative way, unfortunately, was on the men's side. Sinner going out with a hip injury. I saw this terrible video that they put up on Twitter where they made a collage of all the times he was like grabbing his hip in the last couple of tournaments. And it was just like, oh, I didn't even realize that injury has been lingering for him for a while. So, you know, he's like uncomfortable. He's shifting his weight. He's like touching this area on his hip, and he's had it for quite a while, and it's now come to a head, it seems like. So that is very sad. And I mean, that's what happens at the top of this game, right? It takes so much out of your body. So kind of a very sad to see. And yeah, Rublev, one of your favorites, Valerie. So how did you feel about Rublev?
Oh, I was very excited for him. Because I do love Rublev. I think most of the tennis, anyone who follows tennis knows his self-deprecating personality is charming, right? You can't help but root for him because you feel like he's probably going to go home and, I don't know, cry himself to sleep if good things don't happen to him. And just, if you have any compassion as a human, you know, you'll probably spare a thought for Andre Rublev. But yeah, I was super happy for him. Less interested just in watching, though, because I just was, like you said, with Sinner gone, unfortunate. Alcaraz is gone. All the, you know, Nadal lost early. Djokovic isn't even in the tournament. Runa went out. Rude went out. Tsitsipas. I don't even remember. I don't even remember what happened with him in the tournament. I think he just went out early. Right. But like, it just seemed like everything fizzled. And I just started a new job. And I have these sick kittens I'm taking care of. I was like, it was an easy thing to drop, right? I was like, ATP side, I'm just going to, sorry, guys, I'll catch you back in Rome.
Priorities, Valerie, priorities.
Yeah. But go, I'm really, really happy for Rublev, you know, a nice win for him.
I mean, the biggest win has to have been Carlos Alcaraz, and maybe the biggest disappointment of the tournament, because he actually was playing really well. I mean, against Struff, which I really thought was very close, the match before Rublev, very tight. I think two tie breaks in that match in the last two sets, and Carlos was able to pull it out. But he just looked very happy at this tournament. Like his playing style, he was happy. He was hitting winners and he was jeering the crowd, and it was back. It was the old Carlos back. You know, you felt like, oh, wow, he's going to take this. He's so happy. And so it was and he easily handled Rublev in the first set. I felt like it was not really out of place, but Rublev came back. So is there something about Carlos that's a struggle right now, Martin? Anything that you see?
Well, clearly it's unfortunately injury, and the you know, he is remarkably, I'm sure he is still a growing lad, as my mother used to say, still very young. And, you know, it was something that we were discussing just before we began the podcast, Philip, that the extraordinary longevity of the big three, the original big three of Federer, Nadal and Djokovic, that they effectively have all played for 20 years more or less continuously. I mean, they've been 6 months here, maybe longer, only right at the end of their career. That is freakish in any sport. It's what makes them the big three. It makes them the greatest three in any individual sport ever. And we can't immediately assume that, as I call them, the new two of Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner, they're obviously going to lack. They'll have things that they didn't have, but they'll lack things that the big three had. And one of them may be this seemingly, you know, this physical indestructibility, notwithstanding Rafael Nadal's persistent injury problems over the years. So it is a shame to see them go out. I mean, it's a particular shame for Rome, because we wanted to preview Rome as well. And, you know, he was a realistic contender to win there as the first Italian man in Rome, I should say, in nearly half a century. The last Italian winner in Rome was in 1976, Adriano Panatta. Adriano Panatta had one great year in his career where he won his only major, the French Open. He won Rome, his home tournament, and he won the Davis Cup with Italy. He was a very fine player, but that was his annus mirabilis. And I, you know, there was a lot of hope in Italy and among Italian tennis fans that I know, both personally and online. They were looking forward. Jannik had already won the Australian Open, so winning in Rome is great, but he's already a major winner, so he can win it. It's a great shame he'll be missing. It also, if I may say so, slightly scuppers my promotion of my piece for Last Word on Tennis, which is called The Tennissance, the rise of Italian tennis. It's obviously focused largely, especially on the men's side, on Jannik. Like any good writer, hasty rewriting to emphasise the opportunity it presents to the other Italian men to emerge from Jannik's considerable shadow. Foremost among them, I personally hope, is Lorenzo Musetti, who is naturally, you were talking about levels earlier, and who's at his absolute best. I would say Musetti is more naturally talented as a tennis player than Jannik Sinner, but Jannik Sinner has a steely will, an absolute self-determination that you need, that I think at the moment Lorenzo lacks. He can acquire it. He's a former junior world number one. You know, he's a very fine player. I would just add he's also become a father recently, and that can obviously cause, you know, havoc to anyone's life, especially an athlete. But I, for one, would love to see Lorenzo Musetti doing well in Rome, among the other Italian men in particular, if I may mention them as we're previewing Rome as well, are the other hero of Italy's Davis Cup win, Arnaldi, who, you know, is equipped to do well. He's equipped to do well on all surfaces. 6'4", big serve, the classic template, but also comfortable on clay. You've also got Luca Nardi, he of the 50s film star looks, who defeated Djokovic in Indian Wells. And then, you know, there's always Berrettini as well. He's still struggling to get back to fitness, but he is a Wimbledon runner-up at his best. And we hope he can get back to it. There are no guarantees, as we sadly know. But if he can get to back to his best, his is probably the best serve on the men's side of the game, as he proved at Wimbledon in 2021. So there's still a lot to look forward to at Rome. But obviously the loss of Sinner will be considerable. And I will just mention the Italian women to look out for there as well. In particular, Martina Trevisan and Yasmin Paolini, who did so well in the Billie Jean King Cup last year. They got to the final and lost to Canada. There are a number of other Italian women to look out for as well. And in any tournament, in any sport, it's always good when the home team or home player is doing well. It lifts the whole tournament. So especially in the absence of Yannick, we hope that collectively all the other Italian players can step up and show their worth. There's every chance they can. They're all, almost all of them are clay court specialists, or it's their preferred surface. They're at home. Italian tennis is on the rise, as I'll be writing, explaining more in my piece, with the Davis Cup win. But now it's up to the others, especially Musetti. He's the one who has the potential of all of them to be a major winner. He's a long way from it yet, but he has the potential. So I hope he in particular has a good week in Rome.
Yeah, lots of great notes about Rome. Thank you so much. Valerie, what are your thoughts about coming up? What are you excited about?
Well, I'm excited to see the draws. I don't tend to get too much excitement before a tournament until I know who's landed where and what kind of matchups I'm going to see. And I was really sad that the draws aren't out yet, so we didn't get to talk about any potential matchups. But I'm excited. It's a bummer. Sinner and Alcaraz out. Excited to see Djokovic back. He's back for Rome, right?
We believe so. We can't take anything for granted at the moment.
Like you said, we haven't seen the draw, right?
Yeah, and he's an honorary Italian, right? I think he would like
Absolutely.
To think. So I would love to see him be relevant and make a deep run, only so that it really shakes things up for Roland Garros, right? Because I feel like I want the men to have the same intrigue and excitement that the women have right now. So if Djokovic comes in and kicks everyone's butt and goes and wins Rome, I think it will make it real, you know, because he hasn't won a title all year. That's insane.
That is insane.
So, you know, it will definitely make the... And then if he doesn't win... Then going into Roland Garros, he's going in as a defending champion with titleless for the first time probably in the last two decades, maybe, where he's gone this long without a title.
Yeah.
Which to me, that's really the very interesting is what's going on with him. I'd love to see how Paolini does, as Martin said, you know, we hope the Italians do well there. And I think she's been having a really good season and she's fun to watch. She's slayed a couple dragons this year. I think, you know, she's had some real good wins. So I'd love to see her do really well. And I want to see Iga on the slow clay, right? Because Stuttgart and Madrid with the altitude, it's not the clay that she loves. And so this is the first time we get to see her on the slower clay, the one that really suits her game. I'd love to see if Jabeur seemed like she played pretty well this in Madrid. And I'd like to see her make things interesting and kind of make a resurgence into these conversations of being, you know, a real factor. So I'm kind of looking for those headlines. And then, of course, you know, just what we were talking about, Elena. How can she do on the slow clay, right? Can she prove me that, right, in terms of just being like, I can still wipe people off this surface. I don't need grass. Give me any surface and my serve will dominate. You know, so we'll see. I'm just the excitement of it all is really good. I will point out, not to go down a rabbit hole, but I think Rome is doing the whole extended 2-week thing that all the thousands are now. They just announced that Toronto and Montreal are going to do it, and potentially Cincinnati, and then maybe Shanghai. So it seems like all the 1,000s are gearing up towards this whole two-week thing. And I think the point of it was to try and make the tournament, give the athletes more time to be better. And then look at all these withdrawals, right? So it's like, it's kind of like, did it work or was this just bad coincidence? Time will tell. But that being said, I do feel like what I do like about the two-week format is, honestly, I could take a week off of tennis because I kind of really don't watch a lot in the first week. A lot of the matchups aren't that thrilling that I, you know, I feel like, oh, I can do some personal things in my life and wait until next week before all the matches get interesting.
If I may, Valerie, I should have done it earlier. Tsitsipas lost very early on, and it was probably his first match. He probably got a bye in. I believe it was to Thiago Monteiro, the Brazilian player. And although Tsitsipas, that was a very good match. It was probably Monteiro's best performance of his career. So it's notwithstanding, you know, sadly, life is the curse of the tennis loving class. You know, it's. You know, you truly can never get enough. And now these days with globalization and digitization, there's 24-hour tennis around the world, which certainly for older netheads like myself is wonderful. You know, you can disappear down rabbit holes, as you suggested. But I think one other advantage of it, in addition to your very good point about the injury, is it makes the most of what tennis has, which are, you know, it takes place in some of the greatest cities in the world, the truly global cities. So obviously the majors are London, New York, Paris. Melbourne is the, you know, it's the capital of the Pacific Asia region, as it, you know, so it has global reach. And then within Europe, you know, the clay court tour in Europe is, you know, I, like many netheads, I'm sure, I wish, you know, at one point I could just follow it round Europe, because you go from Monte Carlo to Barcelona to Madrid to Rome to Paris, watching the greatest tennis in the world in the most beautiful surroundings, often in the most historic tournaments, or some of the most historic tournaments. And then, of course, you go back to North America, where you have Miami, Cincinnati, which is one of the oldest tennis tournaments in the world, as is Toronto. This is, in the future, like, it's very difficult. It's obviously, for one thing, it's very Northern Hemisphere based. We hope in the future tennis will spread to the rest of the world. Obviously, it's in Shanghai as well, but it would be great in the future. The obvious next place seems to be South America, given the love, you know, in Argentina and Chile, which are tennis powerhouses, but it's big in Brazil, growing in Brazil. And so I'm sure in some, you know, a Masters in Rio would be one of the most glamorous sporting events in the world in any sport. So I think that's what they're trying to do in an increasingly competitive marketplace. I would imagine a number of very shrewd people in both the ATP and WTA, I'm sure there are big factors as well, like the, you know, the injury. You want your star players playing as often as possible. While not forgetting the other players, they've got to have people to play against. But to have this global tour, that is what tennis is like. You know, we wish we could follow it in person ourselves. At the very least, thanks to the wonders of digital technology, we can follow it virtually. And so to go from Madrid to Rome to Paris, you know, to London to New York, it's a global tour. People say that Formula One is something similar, but at the moment that's a very uncompetitive sport, unfortunately. And I say that as someone who's loved Formula One in the past. Tennis is a great global sport, and the increasing focus on the, you know, these nine, you know, they need to make sure that they keep the men and women together, because sometimes, you know, Monte Carlo is a men-only Masters tournament, for example. But in principle, it's good. I think overall for the sport, it's good to have the focus. You've got to have the other smaller tournaments as well. And that again, is one of the great beauties of tennis. It's its own ecosystem. You get tournaments everywhere. And sometimes you'll get a big star turning up in a tiny tournament because he needs to get fit. So the four majors, the nine Masters, you know, the tour finals for both tours, these are the absolute crown jewels. They go to the greatest, some of the greatest cities, many of the greatest cities in the world, probably more than any other sport does. And it's one of the many things that makes tennis so wonderful and so unique.
And so tough for the players, because I can't imagine that these women who just went through this incredible, epic, you know, battle now have to jump on a plane, go to Rome and play at the highest possible level again. And my other thought about what you guys just said was that Djokovic has to be salivating that Carlos Alcaraz and Sinner are injured. Like, this actually gives him a chance if he plays Rome. It kind of makes me feel like Rome is going to be a sad stepchild to Roland Garros, that a lot of people are just going to take it off and try to get healthy, because, of course, everyone's going to want to play Roland Garros. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens in Rome. We're coming up to our time, Valerie. Any last thoughts?
It's so funny. I had one until you said that, and then it just left. So I know that I don't have as hard of a stop. Martin does. So I feel like we should let him for sure get any of his final thoughts out.
Good point. Good point.
Well, we should all do it, Valerie. And I'll make a suggestion or two, and I'm sure we'll all have some thoughts. I mean, it's on your point about Rome. I mean, as you yourself said, perhaps in the past, the situation was worse. It was often, I mean, I don't think they're as compressed as they are now, where you literally have Madrid, Rome, Paris, and they're three great tournaments in their own right. Obviously, Paris is by far the biggest as a major. Nature and tennis in particular abhors a vacuum, Philip. I'm sure new players will emerge next week, or not new players to we netheads, but those who maybe haven't, you know, grab the wider tennis audience and the wider sporting audience. As I'll repeat again, I personally hope that Lorenzo Musetti and Martina Trevisan both do well. They're both terrific players, very different players. But if they could do well, you know, especially Musetti at his best, he is a potential major winner. He's got a long way to go. But he's a terrific player. And Trevisan, anyone who's seen her play, you know, she's just absolutely wonderful to watch. Heart on her sleeve, very dramatic player. Appropriately named after the great Martina Navratilova by her tennis-loving mother, I gather. And she's a very good player. She's been a semi-finalist at Roland Garros, so she certainly can do well at Rome. We hope that she can. And even in the absence of those stars, who, as you said, Philip, are naturally, in some cases at least, resting up for Paris, there's always stories with Novak in particular. A, will he play in Rome? I would have thought he would need to play in Rome, because even the greatest all-round tennis player ever, which he is, you know, it's very hard. I'm sure you'd agree with this as a coach, Philip, to go from one surface to another without, it takes a while to feel, it can't be done. It would be extraordinary. If anyone could do it, it would be Novak, who would turn up at Roland Garros without having played in any other tournament and would still probably be number one favourite, you know, defending champion. But logically, given, you know, by his standards, by his loftiest of standards, he's had a poor year. He's also had a split with his coach, Goran. There are at least two, if they're fit, there are two major winning kids who are, you know, 15, 16 years, you know, it's how the big three work. They all beat everyone else. So that's why it was just left them, you know, to sort it out. And you similarly have it to a certain extent now that Yannick and Carlos, if he gets one in the semi-final, one in the final, can he still do it? It'll be fascinating to see. But here in Rome, I hope he plays. As you said, Valerie, he's almost an honorary Italian. In true Novak style, I believe, by now, he's probably mastered it. He certainly was learning Italian among his other languages, and he's always had a great affinity for that. And when you, if I may, Valerie, I'll just rewinding slightly, when you said you hoped that Novak would be relevant, I just smile wryly, because Novak will always be relevant, whether he's playing or not, because he could not play for a year, come back and win a major. It's obviously more difficult with his advancing years, but he has set his own standards such that, as with the greatest athletes and artists, you do begin to think anything's possible. But logically, he will want to do well in Rome. He'll want to play. He'd like to win, and I'm sure he's got every chance of winning, especially if the other top players are out. It does always give other players a big chance. Philip, you referred to Jan-Lennard Struff earlier. He's in his early to mid 30s. I think he's 33, 34 now. And he just won his first ATP tournament ever in Munich on home clay, which was, he beat Taylor Fritz in a final and really played well. He reached the Madrid final last year where he took Carlos Alcaraz to three sets at his best. He is not a contender to win it, but in tennis terms, he's the blocker. He could knock out someone else. And, you know, there are a whole raft of other clay court specialists, especially from Spain and South America, who will think they won't win it, but they will have a chance of going further if the draw opens up because of injury. So it will always be fascinating. And of course, I should say it's largely down to me that we're shorter this time, at least my contribution, for which I apologise. But we couldn't finish off in Madrid without mentioning Rafael Nadal. And you referred, Valerie, I think you did, Valerie, to his farewell. I did watch that whole game, and we all have our allegiances. And while one should be professionally neutral, you do have allegiances. And what I would say is that even I have a very good friend called Paul, who I call my BTB, my big tennis buddy. We always, you know, we were the only two people years ago who we knew who liked tennis as much. So we keep in touch. He's always been a Raphaelite, a great lover of Nadal. I've always been the king of the Fed heads in a fan capacity, not a writing capacity. You have to be neutral there. But just as Paul had said, he was moved to tears by Federer's farewell at the Laver Cup 2 years ago. I have to say that I certainly shed at least a single tear. It was wonderful. It was a reminder of what it was historic, because in all likelihood, it will be his last match on Spanish clay, on home clay. And I was thinking back, actually, that we've been talking about the rigours of the tour, and it's something that I must look into because I've now piqued my own curiosity. You know, the number of times that we talk about that are, you know, the real tough schedule, but Rafa would often win seemingly every major clay tournament and then the French Open for seemingly half a decade. The odd one might slip through, but it is one of those. It was remarkable at the time. It becomes ever more remarkable when you see what's happening now with players. You know, it may be that after the literal historic high of the big three on the men's side, there will be a slight evening out. You won't have players having three 20-year careers, and they won't be as physically robust as them. But going back to Rafa, he is obviously one of the greatest players ever. And if I may, I would close with one. It was an observation that occurred to me really while watching, which I hope I could share. Big three, everyone loves the big three and certainly should know, you know, whichever one you like, they are linked together forever. And it occurred to me that one, there are many differences between them. The similarity is a great player, but Roger is, no one ever played on the men's side, I stress, on the men's side, no one ever played tennis more beautifully than Roger Federer. On the men's side, no one ever played tennis more dramatically than Rafael Nadal. And on the men's side, no one ever played tennis more efficiently, i.e. well, than Novak Djokovic. And it's, again, a tribute to, we discussed, I referred earlier, tennis is three sports in one. I think in many ways they are, you know, collectively the three-time GOAT. You know, they are going to be linked together forever. And, the two are still standing and we're hopefully going to see them in Rome. And that is going to be fantastic. I think whatever happens, we're into the twilight of the tennis gods now. You know, historically, it's a really fascinating time. And everyone, even if they don't like tennis, frankly, should be trying to watch these players while they can, just as they should have seen Babe Ruth play football or Maradona. Baseball. I apologise. I'm English. Forgive the Babe Ruth play baseball or Maradona play football. You know, these three in particular, and we've still got Nadal and Djokovic playing now. It feels a bit like the one and a half now with Nadal's injuries, but you've got to see them on, even on TV, because they are all-time great sportsmen, not just tennis players, sports people, I should say. They, you know, I said we should close on Rafa, or at least I'd close my contribution. You have to talk about Novak as well. It's going to be fascinating to see what happens in Paris. His goal is obviously he wants to win it for he'll become the guy who wins it, or 25 majors, breaking the tie with Margaret Court, all-time history. It's just going to be fascinating to watch, as always.
Thank you so much, Martin. That was incredible. And yes, I think you're right. We should end with Rafael Nadal. Valerie, your thoughts? And you know, you and I have had this really interesting love-hate relationship with Rafa, right? Because in the beginning, he was beating Roger. But it's become this incredible bromance between the two. And he even announced that he's going to be at the Laver Cup. So you and I talked about whether that would be his dramatic retirement or if it would be Roland Garros, depending on how far he goes. Any thoughts about his loss there and his goodbye at Madrid?
It was a very sweet sentiment. It was lovely to see, you know, his family so close, and they were like losing their minds, crying. I didn't watch it live. I've only seen the videos online, but it's bittersweet. And yeah, definitely Fed head here. Not ashamed to say it because I'm not a professional journalist. I am a person who likes to talk about tennis. So I have no problem having allegiances until someone's paying me to not have them be said. And so, yeah, so as a Fed head, though, you know, yeah, you've kind of learned to love and respect Nadal. And it was definitely sad. And I just really hope that he can have a nice send off at Roland Garros. I would find it a fascinating parallel if he gets blasted the way Fed did at Wimbledon and then doesn't play again until Laver Cup and has a farewell there. I kind of, this is going to sound bad, but part of me wants that to happen so that they kind of like ride off in the sunset in the same way, but just because of the bromance, like you said, Martin.
If I may just add one final thing, don't forget the, I was trying to find the term for it, the major Olympics, the Roland Garros Olympics, which he'll also, he has two chances to win at Roland Garros this year. And in a way, tennis is a relatively late addition to the Olympics. It doesn't have the tradition of other sports, but it does, when you play the Olympics at a major tournament, as Wimbledon was in 2012, I always thought Murray won Wimbledon three times personally because he won the Olympic gold there, which was even that was a once in a lifetime. Yeah, it was arguably harder. Lots of exciting stories about Rafa and Carlos Alcaraz possibly in the doubles. That would be a dream pairing, you know. So it may be, and Rafa has talked about it, if he can't be at his best for Roland Garros, the major, he hopes to be at his best for Roland Garros, the Olympics, and that will be. Then Olympics, you know, tennis will be absolutely forever part of the Olympics, especially if his rate of improvement between Barcelona and Madrid was extraordinary. And that was in a week. If he gets another 2 or 3 months, he skips Wimbledon, say, which why would he go on to grass? There's much more likelihood of injury, just focused on the Roland Garros Olympics. Then, you know, that might be another chance to win it this year if he can't win the major itself, you know, in the next few weeks. Forgive me again for being so brief this time. I hope I will certainly try and make more time next time, Philip. And as always, it's a huge pleasure.
Thank you so much, Martin. It's great to have you. And I'll give you a shout out after you leave at the end of the podcast. But we thank you so much for making time all the way from London. We love your insights. Love following you on Last Word on Tennis and on Twitter. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks again. All the best. Bye, Valerie.
See you in a
Bye,
couple Philip. Weeks.
Bye.
Valerie, yeah, I just wanted to say about Nadal, what a champion, right? What a ultimate icon and role model for all of us who are in tennis. And that's one of the things that I love the most, his fighting spirit, his will to always try to win, never to give up, and really his professional champion attitude as a player, having never thrown a racket, having never completely lost it, you know, on the court, and just been such a great role model for all of us. It just makes me so proud of who he is. And I've got to think for him, it makes him proud that he carried himself in that way, because it is so easy to lose it out there. I've
yeah,
done it many
as we
times.
See, right? So many people do it. I do it every time. Well, that's not true. Not as much anymore, but I used to do it, you know?
Yeah, it's so easy to lose that. And, you know, that's a big part of what we do at the nonprofit, is trying to teach emotional intelligence and having control of our impulses, because that's something kids really need. And he is the best at that. I mean, he has been such a great role model and champion in that way. So wonderful, wonderful to, you know, have him send off. I really hope he sends off in a big way with a win, rather than, you know, not winning. I know it's a big ask, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah. I mean, You're nicer than I am, right? I'm over here just trying to have him follow Fed's path. so Fed doesn't have to feel so lonely about his way. But yeah, great words, Philip, honestly, because that is what is so great about Rafa, is Rafa as a person, also as a tennis player, but he equally, yeah, he was just such a good dude.
He really was.
He is.
He really is.
He is. Like, he's not gone, but yeah, he's great. And it was so hard to root, you know, to not root for him for so many years. And so that was the only positive, was when Fed retired. It freed me up a little bit to like let my love for Rafa grow, you know?
I think a lot of us who are in the Federer camp, like, we're looking to who are we going to support? And, you know, Rafa is the natural choice. So that's wonderful. I'm going to close it up by just offering to people to join us for Mother's Day, which is going to be next Sunday, to send flowers through our nonprofit promotion. We have a partnership with Crayola Flowers, and it allows someone to give flowers and also give back to our charity. So they can go to lovesetmatch.org, click on the link, purchase flowers, and send them anywhere in the United States, and 10% of the profits from the flower sale will go back to our nonprofit. So that supports us here, and we really appreciate that. If you don't mind, Valerie, I'm going to also let people know that our new advanced beginner classes and intermediate classes start on the 18th. So we're kicking off our new classes here in Los Angeles. Super excited about all the new people that are coming out to play and finding tennis and making it their lifestyle and their sport. And then we're gearing up for our summer program in East Los Angeles. We'll be doing 8 weeks of tennis with kids, offering free classes to kids who maybe have never played tennis for 8 weeks in the summer. So that's just going to be a great, great time. I love being out there with those kids and really having great experiences, having them hopefully fall in love with a new sport for them. They can find out more about it at our website, lovesetmatch.org.
Oh, I really highly recommend anyone go check it out. And if you haven't played tennis or you have kids who are interested in it, there's no one better to introduce you to the sport or your children to the sport of tennis than PK. And his team, because if he's not there, he has really a great team of people that are just fantastic. Yeah, so Philip surrounds himself.
Which includes you, Valerie. So thank you so much for being one of my best friends. I love it. And Martin, wow, I love having him. He writes about tennis, including tennis history, on Last Word on Tennis. So you can follow him there at that website. And he also writes about a lot of things. He's a great writer about movies and about Shakespeare. So you can also go to his website, theshakespeareplays.com, and follow him on Twitter, which is MRTNKEADY. Valor, we're going to launch a Tennis Pal Chronicles Instagram soon, right? We're going to do it. It's going to come.
Yes. That will be so cool. And you know what? Just to backtrack really quick, there wasn't a lot of time, but maybe I should set up an email and see if we do a Challengers watch and a Challengers episode, because Martin is so into cinema. So I wonder if he plans to see the movie.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And it's so great for tennis, right? That she's out there being a role model and all those young girls looking up to her saying, hey, tennis is cool. And boy, I'm really excited about that. I know in the back of my mind, I was like, I would love to have her on the podcast or someone from the movie, right, to talk about it. Just the fact that it was tennis. I guess Brad Gilbert was the tennis coordinator, tennis professional, who helped to train them to learn how to play tennis. And what a great movie. I'm excited. I haven't seen it myself, so I'm looking forward to it.
I'm trying to think. I just listened to a podcast recently. Was it with the writer of the movie? Very interesting episode. Gave a lot of background information. And Brad Gilbert has so much to do. I think he was like the inspiration for the movie. And so it kind of was like a full circle thing that he ended up working on the movie. No Challenges Remaining, maybe. Yeah, No Challenges Remaining. Last week, screenwriter Justin Kuretsky's I'm probably saying that wrong. Anywho, I recommend it if you're interested. Give it a listen. It's pretty interesting. A lot of background information about how just the person who wrote the movie kind of got into tennis and then decided they were going to write a movie about it and got really into it. And yeah, I'm very excited to see it. If you're going to see it,
okay, let's see it together. Absolutely, yeah. And we'll put it out there on Instagram to have people join us if they're in the LA area. That would be really fun. Tennis
heck
party.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
Thank
Sounds
you, Valerie,
good.
So much for being a part of this wonderful podcast, Tennis Pal Chronicles. Thank you for making time and putting the notes together. You are amazing. Woo! And
you're
for all
best,
of you
Phillip.
Listening, if you want to send us an email, please send it to coachpk@lovesatmatch.org. We would love to hear from you. I would love to hear any comments that you have. And if you want to come to the movies with us, we'd love to hear from you too. We'll tell you when we're going to go. May all your serves be aces. Aces!
Elena Rybakina,
right.
Aces!
Talk to you soon.